After a sometimes tense meeting and dozens of comments from citizens, the Clark County Board of Education decides on the future of the West Broad Farmers Market. We'll hear from School Superintendent Damond Means.
I appreciate our Board of Education continuing to ask me to seek a middle ground, a common ground with our friends from the Land Trust, and it's my sincere hope that we will come out of this with something solidified.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. We'll also take a trip into the weird, wonderful world of found footage.
I give this old Western thriller 5 Mickeys.
Those stories plus our panel of commentators coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Last week, dozens of community members turned out to a meeting of the Clark County Board of Education to express their opinions on the future of the West Broad Street school site. Currently home to a farmer's market and community garden operated by the Athens Land Trust, the school district has been evaluating plans to redevelop the site. Here to talk about that, as well as the continuing saga of ethics complaints among the board and Superintendent Damond Means, are Blake Odd of Flagpole Magazine, Gwen O'Looney with WXAG, and Lee Shearer with the Athens Banner-Herald. Blake, those ethics complaints are still festering out there. Where do things stand?
Well, there was a complaint filed with Advance Ed, which now actually is known as Cognia, but they are the accreditation organization that accredits K-12 schools and colleges in the Southeast, alleging that some of the board members had been attempting to micromanage the school district, and Superintendent Damond Means responded to that those allegations in a rather scathing letter, saying that the situation in the district is dire and imploring Advance Ed to come in and mediate between himself and the three school board members that he's had some disagreements with, John Knox, Tawana Maddox, and Greg Davis.
Supporting those allegations, I think we should say, Means is.
And in very adamant and adversarial language, it was very condemning. They're not reaching out to each other in these correspondences.
And the three board members are saying that these allegations against them basically is an attempt by the superintendent to intimidate and silence them because they've been asking questions about some of his policies, hiring practices, things of that nature that he apparently doesn't appreciate.
Right.
I can see where someone might find John Knox intimidating, not because of him, but because he asked questions. He was the college professor of the year in the state of Georgia 5 years ago, and one thing he likes is data, and he's constantly asking for data, information about things that's not always there.
And the board's position, I agree with Lee. We need active, involved, and asking board members. We need people that are reaching out and learning about these things, and I looked over all of the exhibits that were attached to Dr. Means' response to Advance Ed, which was very negative, and I could not find any example of a board member asking questions without explaining that they didn't want to be illegal, that they were looking for guidance, that they didn't want to micromanage, but they wanted to understand. And it was really interesting to me that Means is the one that for the first time shared the names of the principals who had who were not going to continue in Clark County as people who had violated and deserted the school system, which to me was really inappropriate. The terminology that's being used to me is adversarial, and we have got to move into a position of partnership with goals being clearly defined by the board. That's their job. The policies involved and moving forward. This is a problem.
Do you see that actually happening in this situation?
What I see right now is that I agree with the board's decision to hire someone who is more neutral and unbiased to respond to advanced ed. I think that's important.
Well, one of the interesting things is actually that decision to
the resolution?
That decision to hire outside counsel, which the board has not done yet.
Right.
Was one of the reasons why Dr. Means supported the allegations in his letter. He actually cited that as a example of the board usurping the authority of the superintendent because he had told them when they approved the resolution that they were not allowed to hire their own outside counsel, even though the district's own attorney had told them that they could do that and, in fact, should do that.
Yes.
And this entire time, in addition to that, Dr. Means has had his own personal attorney that he has hired from Wisconsin who's been representing him and who he has discussed these issues with. So that's, you know, he's allowed apparently to have his own taxpayer-funded outside counsel, but the board is
representing him or advising him at this point.
Well, it's hard to say.
But
I don't, you know, that's attorney-client privilege. A lot of that stuff is redacted, so I don't know the specifics.
Presumably, the accreditation agency is neutral. That's who's going to conduct an investigation, and presumably they will talk to everyone fairly. We'll see.
And the potential outcome of this is that they could remove the school board. So you could see this, even though the superintendent works for the board, you could see this as an effort by the superintendent to basically have his own board fired. And based on the language that he used, you know, talking about this relationship is just irrevocably broken.
Right.
I can't see a situation where we continue on like this.
And my worries about this, because I love public education so much, and I really believe that it's crucial that we have faith and credibility in our public schools. And I've been telling people, I'm saying, look, this is a great time to get involved with your child's school. This is a great time to be an advocate for public education, to move us on the local level. We've got problems at the top, evidently. They are not getting along. But I think every parent should right now make a commitment to going to school and making sure that their teacher, and we have great teachers. We have most of the people I talk to really appreciate the education their child is getting. And I think that we need to be in a position to where our community rallies around public education and kind of holds that position as long as it takes these people to get their personality problems solved.
There's some great things going on in the school district.
That's right.
Down below, the stuff going on at the top. I wrote this article a while back, which is the kind of article I would much rather be writing than about these disputes, about these kids out at Cedar Shoals High School who are converting a former SWAT truck into a food truck for the school district. That kind of stuff is wonderful, and it's happening in a lot of places. There's some big issues that Means is trying to address in his perhaps ineffective way, the big discrepancies between the achievements of African-American kids and white kids and so forth, the inequities. But it's hard to see how progress is going to be easy on that front right now.
Let's talk about the vote last week where the board did support Dr. Means' proposal regarding the West Broad School. So one obvious point of contention is that the West Broad Farmers Market and Garden is leaving the site.
Well, they were going to be leaving the site anyway because the superintendent opted not to renew their agreement to operate the community garden and farmers market on that site, regardless of how the vote had gone down in terms of the early learning facility that Dr. Means wants to open. So the Athens Land Trust is looking for other sites in that neighborhood to continue, possibly on other district property at Clark Middle, maybe, maybe not, maybe some other place. But
yeah, he did say he wanted to kind of work with them.
He said he was willing to work with them. You know, that's been a strained relationship as well, so I don't know if that's going to happen. But the Land Trust has said they are committed to continuing somewhere in the neighborhood. In regards to the Early Learning Center, we have a waiting list for pre-K, early Head Start, and Head Start programs, pre-kindergarten, that type of thing. But
more than 100.
You know firsthand, Blake.
It's, It's less now. Yes, I know my daughter had to go through that process last year, but it's pretty stressful waiting to find out whether you're going to get a slot. So,
and how many vacancies are, not vacancies, I'm sorry, how many slots are, how many people are waiting, kids that can't get on
the last figure I heard was 20, but it was a lot higher than that a few months ago. I think some people have probably dropped off the waiting list since then. It was bigger earlier in the year, but there's a lot of obstacles still left. There's not a lot of detail in this plan. The Athens Neighborhood Health Center has not yet agreed to staff the health clinic that is proposed.
Says they've never been asked.
Right, and they're staffing the one on the east side, but they have not agreed to staff the one on the west side. So there's that. There's the Department of Education has to approve this site for an early learning center. There are a lot of criteria that could throw a monkey wrench in this whole thing. You know, the proximity to a four-lane state highway, the traffic situation, proximity to a nightclub. You know, there's just a lot of issues and hurdles that have to be worked out before this actually comes to fruition.
We are actually low on time, but let me ask quickly, what do you guys think is next? What's the next step?
Right. The next step has to be for the board, I think, to hire their attorney to make a balanced report, because it's crucial that Advanced Ed see this community as being operating good schools.
I'm not sure they will right now.
We'll have to leave it there for this week, but before we go, one update on a story we discussed 2 weeks ago. You may remember our discussion about issues at the Athens-Clarke County Animal Shelter. According to Joe Johnson at Classic City News, Athens-Clarke County Central Services Director David Fluck, whose department oversees animal control, has resigned at the behest of County Manager Blaine Williams. Coming up after the break, my conversation with Clarke School Superintendent Damon Means about the future of the West Broad Street school site. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters on WUGA. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. At a sometimes contentious meeting last week, members of the Clarke County School Board made a final decision about the fate of the West Broad Farmers Market. Operated by the Athens Land Trust, the market and its community garden have been in the spotlight as Clarke County Schools eyed the site for potential redevelopment. I sat down with School Superintendent Damon Means at his office last week to talk about the decision and the future of the West Broad site. Our conversation started with Means' reaction to last week's board meeting.
We had a very good board meeting. I think it was a highlight of what democracy looks like. We had a number of different guest speakers come to the microphone and advocate for different perspectives, and I think that was healthy and good. The Board of Education affirmed the proposal that the administration forwarded regarding the future of the West Broad campus. That recommendation from administration was that we would green light a project that would allow us to create a facility that is a brand new facility that fronts the Campbell Street side of that campus. We would build a brand new facility that's about 25,000 square feet. We would also renovate the West Broad building that is facing Minor Street to create a West Side school-based health clinic. It would provide a student success center, and it would create community rooms. So I think the one component that we are really pleased with is that we've made an overture to the Athens Land Trust, and we're open to potentially sharing that facility that would be facing Campbell Street. We're open to those conversations, and I think the Land Trust is deliberating over that right now. We also reiterated our proposal and our invitation for the land trust to relocate the farmer's market to the campus of Clark Middle School. We value the relationship with the land trust, and we want to see that relationship continue. And then finally, we're going to move forward with the memorandum of understanding being extended to December 31st to allow the land trust to finish this season of the farmer's market.
You presented a $10 million proposal. What would you say about the support you received?
I think the support was around our kids. I tried to focus it back on our students. The concept around early childhood education, I believe, is really critical for our community as it pertains to addressing poverty and addressing some of the challenges that some of our kids don't come to school ready for instruction. We know the research shows that high quality childhood education is that antidote, if you will, to addressing some of the challenges that our kids come to school with for the first time. So I think that was a helpful component to the proposal and was an element to its passage. I think the fact that we stayed focused on community and collaboration was very important. I appreciate our Board of Education continuing to ask me to seek a middle ground, a common ground with our friends from the Land Trust, and it's my sincere hope that we will come out of this with something solidified. But I think the true winners of this vote is the community. The kids are going to receive more opportunities for early childhood education opportunities. The community still have a chance to have the farmers market located right in the West Broad corridor, and we're gonna actually do a facelift, if you will, of that portion of the West Broad corridor by having new facilities and renovating something that is so very important to our entire community.
What would you say to, I guess, any parents, citizens, or even board members who may disagree with some of the plans?
It is rare in public policy and public life to get a unanimous, universal support for any initiative. What I can say is that we have done our due diligence up to this point. We still have a lot of planning to do. There's still a lot of investigating that we need to do and engage a lot of different partners, be it at the Department of Education or other places. So we're just at the beginning stage of this work, but I would say to dissenters or people who don't who had some criticism of the proposal is that I appreciate their feedback. I think iron sharpens iron, and I would always ask people to remember that whatever I bring to the table as superintendent is with good intent.
Dr. Damon Means is the superintendent of schools for Clark County. We spoke last week at his office.
Earlier this week, nearly 50,000 General Motors workers walked off the job as contract negotiations between the United Auto Workers and GM stalled. While unions like the UAW are a significant part of the labor economy in the Rust Belt, they've been less of a factor in the South. WUGA contributor Gene Davis brings us this historical look.
Unions in the South have had a fraught and often unsuccessful struggle to play a part. I asked Cindy Hahamovich, the B. Finnessy Spaulding Distinguished Professor of History at UGA, about the history of the labor movement in Georgia and what Georgia's status as a right-to-work state means for unions. What is a right-to-work law?
A right-to-work law is a law meant to guarantee that a worker can get a job without joining a union, so that you have the right to work without joining a union. The original right-to-work laws were passed in 1947, and the intention was to roll back the gains that unions had made during the 1930s, during the New Deal. So those were minimum wage, maximum hours, the ban on child labor, the 40-hour work week. And then in the 40s, we get a coalition of Republicans who dominated Congress at that point, working together with conservative Democrats, most of them Southerners, to try to roll back those gains. And that's where they succeed in getting the Taft-Hartley Act passed. And that's what we know of as the first right-to-work law.
So the Taft-Hartley Act limited the power of unions. What did that look like in practice?
Their purpose was both to limit the power of unions and to limit their spread, but also to prevent the spread of civil rights. Because if you think about it, most Black people in the South were prevented from voting as a result of disfranchisement laws passed earlier in the century. But in the union movement, Black people were voting. And the CIO was very actively organizing Black workers and white workers together, women and men, the native-born and the foreign-born, the skilled and the unskilled, all together. And that was very threatening to white supremacists in the South. So part of the goal of Taft-Hartley is to stop the spread of labor unions into the South, and it was largely successful.
Georgia is one of 27 states that have adopted right-to-work laws and is currently ranked 46th out of 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, for percent of union members. But Hahamovich says the labor movement here has a legacy outside of just union membership.
We tend to think of the South as a place where there are no unions and there's never been labor organizing, and it's just not true. W.E.B. Du Bois talks about the Civil War as a general strike, that so many workers, so many slaves during the Civil War essentially put down their tools and walked away from their owners, walked away from their plantations and crossed over union lines. Some of them, you know, then enlisted in the Union Army. Some of them became labor for the Union Army. But it was in some ways a giant strike. So there's been all kinds of labor actions in the South. But they've often been outside the formal labor movement. And so they haven't always been recognized as labor actions, but they were.
So what can you tell me about the strike that happened here in Athens in the 1940s among textile workers?
So I don't know very much about it yet. My students in my class and I are working on an electronic tour of industrial Athens. So Athens, Georgia was the first industrial town, the first sort of mill town in the South. This place was as much a mill town as it was a college town in the 19th century and through much of the 20th century. We're just trying to figure out what happened and where. We were talking to Maxine Isim and Patty Arnold, who have a new book about East Athens, which is where most of the mills and the mill workers were located. And lo and behold, they have a mention of a very long strike right in the period of Taft-Hartley. And there's only a small entry. And so we were excited to investigate and see, find out more about that.
Well, thank you for speaking with me, Cindy.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Jean Davis is a journalist and WUGA contributor. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
WUGA supports the educational mission of the University of Georgia. Internships are available each semester in radio programming, production, news, and social media for students currently enrolled in college-level study. Information at WUGA.org or 706-542-3324.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Let's talk about bugs, the creepy, gross, sometimes scary, and the guests of honor at the 28th Annual Insectival, a celebration of our six-legged neighbors. Here to talk about this year's festival, which is coming up on Saturday, September 28th at the State Botanical Garden in Athens, is Corey Kieber, Director of Education at the State Botanical Garden of Georgia. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So 28 years, what is it about insects that has kept people coming back for the better part of three decades?
That is an incredible question. It's fun. It's an annual event. It is unique. There is not very many festivals that focus on insects and bugs that are our wonderful ambassadors to learning about the environment.
This is big with kids, I would guess. You get a lot of kids to this stuff, right?
Yes, we do. Ann Schenck, my predecessor at the garden, always used to say, little things love little things. And so kids love insects. They love learning about them, talking about them, catching them. I think that when we're kids, our fear factor is a little lower than when we are adults. Bugs are a little more on their level, closer to the ground where they are, where where we become a little more disconnected by not seeing them or noticing, because our minds become, as adults, we're focusing on other things, where kids are focusing on what's in front of them and what they see. So it definitely is a big draw with our children.
So what kind of activities can attendees expect this year? I mean, like, what's new and what's backed by popular demand?
Every year we have a series of 9 different stations. So what is an insect? So many different kinds of insects is what we call Station 3, where the Georgia Museum of Natural History will come and set up beautiful displays of many different bugs and insects from around the world. We have a life cycle station for insects, senses and communication, so how bugs communicate with each other, how they find their lunch, how they find their mates. We also have insects as predators and prey, insectivory in plants, so we talk about the relationship of bugs and plants. And we have tons of live displays and bugs.
Okay, so one of the biggest parts of the festival every year is the butterfly release on the International Garden Lawn. This year, though, there are actually 2 releases planned. Why is that?
This year, we're going to have a butterfly release at 10:30 and 12:30. And the reason for that is we have noticed over the years how popular this event is, and there tends to be a mad rush to get to the butterfly release before it takes place. And so this year, we thought we would extend the festival and give different groups, different opportunities. So if you tend to be an early riser, you could come to the 10:30 showing. If you tend to be need a little extra time in the morning with an extra cup of coffee, you can come at 12:30.
Oh, that's really cool. Well, do you have a particular goal for the festival every year, or has it changed over time?
I think the biggest goal that we are looking for in this festival is insects can become ambassadors to environmental stewardship. So bringing people to the garden to experience the love of nature, and then it becomes something that we want to care for later. So I think that becomes a big outcome of the project, is this is one entry-level point to bring people into environmental stewardship.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention you lost a member of the insectable team this year, Dr. Marianne Shockley, who was killed in May. And Dr. Shockley was a member of the UGA Department of Entomology and was involved with insectival for nearly 20 years. Talk about the difficulties moving forward without her.
Yes, you are correct that we lost a great member. I was reflecting on this earlier, thinking this might come up. And Marianne would come into every single meeting incredibly bubbly. So anyone that knew her, knew that she would just come in with extreme enthusiasm. So it became this, it was almost just like she checked off all the check boxes on our to-do list a lot of times. But one beautiful thing is Marianne has a lot of great mentees that come behind her. And so one of her students, Allison Johnson, has really stepped into a leadership role, which has been a beautiful thing to see. And she'll be missed.
That's awesome. Well, Cora Kieber is the Director of Education at the State Botanical Garden of Georgia at UGA. The garden will host the 28th Annual Insectival on Saturday, September 28th. Thank you so much for sharing some time with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This weekend, the University of Georgia and Notre Dame face off on the football field. But away from the stadium, the two schools are partners in the study of Germany and its role in the EU and the world. UGA professor Martin Coggle sat down with Alan Fleury, host of the podcast Unscripted. Here's a portion of their conversation.
On September 21st, the University of Georgia Bulldogs and the University of Notre Dame Fighting Irish meet in Athens for the second leg in the home-and-home series between the two college football powers. Off the field, the two universities share a vision for scholarly collaboration also in its second year, the Berlin Seminar in Transnational European Studies, a joint initiative of UGA's Franklin College of Arts and Sciences and Wilson Center for Humanities and Arts, and Notre Dame's Nanavik Institute for European Studies. The Berlin Seminar is a week-long residency in early June focused on advancing the discourse on both campuses of issues related to Europe, the EU, and Germany's role in the European Union. Joining us today on Unscripted is Martin Coggle, A.G. Steer Professor of German at UGA, associate dean in the Franklin College, and co-director of the Berlin Seminar. So how did the idea for a collaboration with Notre Dame originate?
Well, it originated in an article that my colleague Bill Donahue and I wrote for the Chronicle of Higher Education a few years ago. And the article focused on our field, which is German studies. And it made the argument German studies in its current configuration doesn't really represent Germany anymore because the political situation in Germany had changed. It had become part of the European Union. And we needed to consider Germany within Europe more broadly and move to a different kind of representation of national literatures and cultures.
That's where we get to transnational European studies. So maybe we should drop back and define exactly what we're talking about when we say that.
So the term transnational in its most direct form means beyond national borders. But the way we conceptualize it is that it reflects the flow of ideas, of people, of goods, services, capital among different nations. So the reality of the European Union, for example, right now is that there is no one single nation, but there is a group of nations. And within those nations, ideas migrate, literatures migrate, political policies migrate. They go back and forth. They influence each other. And that's what the term signifies. The seminar is not about the EU, even though I use the EU as example frequently. It's about Europe, and Europe is larger than the European Union. For the seminar, transnational means a couple of other things as well. First of all, the seminar is not Eurocentric. So transnational means that we also look beyond European borders and that we're interested in the relationship between Europe and other continents, other nations outside of Europe.
The themes of this year's seminar were, appropriately enough, migration, populism, and nationalism. And these are phenomena that are taken directly from today's headlines, but at the same time, the developments push and pull from deeper historical currents that might have receded from memory into history to some extent. How do scholars, and at the same time journalists and politicians and judges and artists, cross the divide between the topicality and its history?
Well, that's a very good question. Sometimes we do include historians among the panelists, and they do look back at kind of transnational moments in European history, which were moments, let's say, in 1918, 1945, so the end of World War I, the end of World War II, 1968, very important, the student revolt across both Western and Eastern Europe at the time. And then 1989, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of communist regimes in Europe. So those are important kind of transnational moments that relate to very strongly to the contemporary history of Europe. Seminar's focus is on contemporary Europe overall. So the journalists that we invite this past year, for example, we invited Adam Nossiter, who is the Paris bureau chief of the New York Times, who spoke to us about the Yellow Vest movement. We had Tom Nuttall, who is the Berlin bureau chief of The Economist, who spoke to us about current German politics. And their focus is very much in the present. When we have discussions, we as Americans go to Europe to talk to European experts about Europe. One purpose of this is to have another angle on our own experience here in the United States.
Do you think we have any misperceptions about how fluid the relationships might be between the U.S. and the countries within the EU?
I think so. I mean, one reason why we created the seminar was because we felt that the discussion on our campuses about Europe were not as active, as vibrant, as contentious, as rich and substantive as they are in Europe itself.
Martin Coggle is the A.G. Steer Professor in UGA's Department of Germanic and Slavic Studies and Associate Dean of the Franklin College of Arts and Sciences. He spoke with WUGA contributor Alan Fleury, host and producer of the podcast Unscripted, available at franklin.uga.edu/unscripted.
Have you ever stumbled upon old video cassettes at a flea market or a thrift store? A 1980s workout tape complete with big hair and spandex,
or maybe an arts and crafts video that was sold alongside an As Seen on TV product. If so, you probably don't buy them, but two men have literally made careers out of doing exactly that. Wisconsinites Nick Pruer and Joe Pickett started collecting old videotapes back in 1991, and over the past 28 years, they've accrued quite a collection of these embarrassingly bad videos. They've decided to showcase some of these videos with a roadshow called the Found Footage Festival. The two men bring this carnival of weirdness to Sine on September 28th. We're joined by one of the two men behind the Found Footage Festival, Nick Pruer. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for using the term men. I think that's charitable.
Well, tell us a little bit about what we can expect when the Found Footage Festival makes its way to Athens.
The show is it's a guided tour through my childhood friend Joe and my VHS collection. So we have running commentary throughout the show on the videos. And yeah, it's sort of half comedy show, half screening of these VHS clips that were never meant to be seen in public. The last time we were in Athens, I think we were just in the middle of a federal lawsuit. This is the first time we featured footage of ourselves, because as part of that lawsuit, we were deposed. And at the end of the lawsuit, they were like, okay, well, here's your legal bill. Here's your paperwork. Oh, did you want the footage from your depositions? We were like, oh, it's so painful. Do we do it? And we decided to spring for the deposition footage. And we cut together a montage we called The Worst of Deposition.
How did you come up with just the idea to take this on the road and showcase some of these absurd videos with this roadshow thing?
It started gradually. I mean, Joe and I, we grew up in a small town in Wisconsin and were bored teenagers, and we'd be in my parents' living room watching whatever we had found at the Goodwill.
Disney World, one kid's opinion.
The Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. I give this old Western thriller 5 Mickeys.
I saw this thing and I'm thinking, you know, this kid is almost doing a video blog before there was even such a thing. Where did you find this clip?
In high school, we would always just keep a tape in the VCR, and if something came on that we thought was funny or interesting, we'd hit record. And I still don't have the first 5 minutes of the show. I just have, you know, when we started watching it at 2 a.m. on our local public access station, we got the last half of it. And yeah, it's a 10-year-old, precocious 10-year-old kid's review of his trip to Disney World with his family. And so, yeah, a lot of these people, like, the technology wasn't there, but the ideas were.
Thank you so much for your time. And may I say, I hope your show gets at least 5 Mickeys.
Oh, thank you so much. God willing.
Nick Pruer is one of the organizers of the Found Footage Festival, which visits Sine on Saturday, September 28th at 7:30 and 9:30 p.m., And by the way, Sine is a financial supporter of WUGA. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
Hours ago, halfway around the world, the day has already begun.
Tens of thousands of people in Venezuela.
Britain is leaving the European Union.
Everyone was just running. People were crying. They were in tears. And we didn't know what was happening. Police kept telling us to move back, move back.
The thousands of protesters marched along a route.
When you need to know where the world went while you weren't looking. Morning Edition. Listen every morning.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shue. Ken Stringfellow has performed with R.E.M., the Posies, and many other bands in addition to his prolific work as a solo artist. He's on a national tour, and he'll be coming to Athens Flicker Theater and Bar on Saturday, September 28th. Stringfellow took some time away from his touring schedule to talk to WUGA's Molly Williams. Here's their conversation.
Well, first I want to say thank you so much for making Touched. It was an album that was really important to me when it first came out. And I'm kind of curious for you, after a bit of time away from it, what it's like to steep yourself in these songs again.
Well, to be fair, they've never really left me. I still play snippets of them in many of my shows. So these songs are still really close to me. I feel like what this record came from, and I think why it's so effective, because, you know, what took to write those songs was not so fun. And I went through some hard times emotionally. So that album is a little bit of me kind of coming out of the well of despair and looking for something to, you know, hopeful to bring me out of it. And who can't relate to that? You know,
right.
Everybody could use that kind of encouragement. What we should mention, what kind of fused this record into a lot of people's minds, is that its release date is September 11th, 2001.
Right.
And coming out of the well of despair and looking for something hopeful was definitely on a lot of people's minds at that time, myself included. And Touched seemed to be a prepared response. It was kind of the right balance. And of course, how could I have known? I didn't know.
Right. It's still pretty upbeat in terms of the melodies and the harmonies on it. It feels, you know, power poppy, very much like the work you did with the Posies. But what is it going to be like to take sort of the driving songs that are on this record and then play them with a piano or an acoustic guitar in these sort of more intimate settings and get more in touch with the emotion in the music itself?
I think you'll be surprised how powerful it is, even though it's just me on stage. What happens when some of the other instruments drop away is that what remains, just through the trick of perspective, gets bigger. You know, the least worst solution to my band breaking up is I could still play by myself. This is kind of hinted at in Find Yourself Alone, the song Untouched.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I realized that it was its own special thing that actually had something real interesting to offer that a band could never offer in terms of that kind of emotional directness.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that surprised you about recording Touched in particular?
I think it really took the
Well, and I think you're right. They needed the performance and they needed the reassurance that comes through the music, and to have the emotional engagement with you and with the songs in a different way and in a public space was probably very necessary in the wake of 9/11.
You could definitely disappear into your own, you could wallow in your own thoughts at that point and feel very alone. The first tour date I played after 9/11, nobody was ready. You know, it was weird, of course, but I carried on. And then I played in New York on September 20th, 9 days later, and people were ready. They were ready to stop looking at the TV and to stop just, you know, staring at their cocktail and going, what in the world just happened to all of us?
That was part of the inspiration, right, for this tour, was that the Mercury Lounge had you come back for part of their 25th anniversary celebration to play almost exactly to the date of your show 18 years ago.
Exactly. So the show in 2001 was at the Mercury Lounge, and 18 years and one day later, they invited me back for their anniversary, and being that it was that date, basically, and I thought, well, of course I should play Touched kind of officially. And once I announced that, there was lots of other people interested in seeing that show.
Ken Stringfellow comes to Flicker Theater and Bar on Saturday, September 28th, and he spoke to WUGA contributor Molly Williams. And we should note, Flicker is a financial supporter of WUGA. You can hear the full version of this conversation next Monday and Wednesday night on The Guest List. Finally today, let's talk about football, and specifically football rivalries, big games like Alabama-Auburn, Texas-Oklahoma,
Michigan and Ohio State.
Shout out to your alma mater.
Go Blue. But how about a rivalry that comprises only two games, with a third scheduled for this weekend? WUGA's John Slights makes the case for UGA and Notre Dame, the most exciting rivalry you may never have thought of.
The year was 1887. And Notre Dame fielded its first football team. 5 years later, some 700 miles south, the University of Georgia fielded its first football team. It took nearly 90 years before the two gridiron powerhouses would first meet, and another 30-plus years before they would have a rematch. But I submit that the Georgia-Notre Dame game is more than an occasional blip on the college football radar. It's two historic programs fighting for overall dominance in the series. It may not be a yearly happening, but it is, and should be, a rivalry. If you know anything about Georgia football, you know the story of that first game. It's 1980, and Vince Dooley's Bulldogs are undefeated. It's been a magical season.
There's a hole. Five. My God almighty, he ran right through two men.
Lindsey Stock.
In the Sugar Bowl, Georgia meets the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, a 9-1-1 team. Yes, college football had ties back then, with the winner likely earning the national championship.
Georgia has won 17-10.
Georgia won the game and the national championship, and it would be the last time the two teams would meet until 2017. Like the Sugar Bowl 37 years before, it was a tight game throughout. Georgia pulled out the win on the road in South Bend, and just as noteworthy, the stadium was packed with rabid, zealous Georgia fans. The fan base was fired up for this second meeting, and, not content with flooding Notre Dame Stadium, some audacious Georgia fans even took it upon themselves to do some good old-fashioned trolling, calling the Dogs during Notre Dame coach Brian Kelly's call-in show in front of a live audience. And by the way, that game turned out pretty well, too.
The receiver possessed the ball, got a foot down inbounds, therefore we have a touchdown.
2 years later, and South Bend comes to Athens. College game day in Myers Quad, a primetime slot on CBS, and serious stakes for both teams. Notre Dame hasn't started and finished a season in the top 10 this century, and Georgia is a possible playoff team with a chip on its shoulder. So what makes for a rivalry? Well, in the end, a rivalry might best be defined by great games, season-defining games that drive fans of both teams to the brink of elation and madness. And by that measure, the UGA-Notre Dame rivalry is one worth following. For WUGA, I'm John Slights.
John Slights is a master's student in UGA's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication and one of our hardworking segment producers.
This has been Athens News Matters from WUGA. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget, if you missed part of this week's show, you can listen again online at wuga.org or on the NPR One app or the WUGA app, available for Apple and Android wherever you get your apps. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News.